This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's me, Dan the Fitness Man. We're on Elk Shape Podcast. This is the podcast for you blue-collar hunters that want to bust up that elk hunting learning curve or want to be more consistent killers on the public land, which is opposite of the private land. You are the guys buying your tags at Walmart. You guys are the ones that have a 9-to-5, 40-plus-hour work week, family, bunch of other obligations, and you're passionate about elk hunting. You want to crush the elk hunting learning curve. You want to be more consistent at killing elk. This is the podcast for you. We are sponsored by Delayed Gratification, hard work and hustle, and having ownership or accountability for your actions. So we preach discipline and fitness, but we talk about elk tactics mostly. All my sponsors are on elkshape.com. All of them are more like partners. They help put this thing together. Your guys' support. Check out the Elk Shape store. Today we're bringing on Dirk Durham, the Bugler. He has been seen with the Elk 101 guys. He's been on the Born and Raised Land of the Free. He hunts a ton of public land. He's a blue collar. He works 410s, has a wife, kids. And he does it all. He competes at elk calling competitions. He's everywhere. But we have him here tonight to talk about how noobs can tackle hunting elk in Idaho, all over Idaho. We talk about the wolf population. We talk about how to have a mobile hunting station for when you're hunting out of state. And being mobile is really critical to upping your chances of success. We talk about a lot of different topics, including some of the calls that he has helped make with Phelps Game Calls and how to use those to best bring those elk in closer. So enjoy this episode. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. And enjoy. Elk Shape Podcast with me, Dan the Fitness Man. We're doing the blue collar elk hunting learning curve today. Special guest from Idaho, Dirk Durham. What's up, buddy?
Oh, hey there.
Oh, hey.
Just got done with work. Just got done for work for the day and for the week. It's my Friday, so it's good.
You doing the 410 life?
Yeah, 410 life is the best.
What time do you start?
6 a.m.
Cool. Well, who is Dirk the Bugler Durham?
I'm just a regular guy from north central Idaho who happens to like to hunt elk. I happen to love to hunt elk, actually.
Okay, simple as that. So your son, Austin, trained at my gym for a little while. Got to meet him.
Yeah.
He is a great guy. Didn't think he was super into elk hunting.
No.
What in the hell? So if my son's not into elk hunting, what advice do you have for me?
I don't know. I'm still trying to cope with it. Austin is awesome. He's a great kid. Pretty passionate about other things, but he's not really into elk hunting. He likes to go to, just to be with dad. He does it for me, I think. But he's not driven, you know, to go the extra mile and do all the crazy stuff that I'm willing to do to get an elk. So, which is okay. You know, he likes other stuff and And I don't know if maybe I ruined him when he was little. I took him hunting all the time when he was a little guy. And then later, as soon as he could actually have a license and hunt himself, I took him all the time. And you know, hunting, you know, you have a lot of slow days before, you know, that magical day happens. And I don't know, maybe he just didn't think those slow days were worth it.
Well, that's interesting. So maybe later in life, he'll want to pick up where he left off. And then do you have any other kids?
I do. I have a daughter, Samantha. She's in college still. And she took her hunting all the time too, when she was little. She loves to be outdoors. She's actually has her own business. She's a photographer, and she's kind of supplementing her way through college with doing senior portraits and weddings and other things like that. And she likes to go hunting, but she don't really have the time for it. She's either doing school or doing photography. And then now she's engaged to a guy who's big into MMA. And so he's got her training jujitsu, and that's like lit a huge fire under her, and she loves jujitsu. So there's no time for hunting.
I see. And where's she going to school at?
She goes to school at LCSC in Lewiston, Idaho.
Okay. So you're like, what, 30 minutes outside of Lewiston?
It's about 45.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. You live in some pretty remote country. You can get to some good stuff, and, beautiful. I was telling you on the phone last week, I was like, I finally drove. Is that what? Highway 12?
Highway 12. Yeah.
Finally made it all the way from Lewiston to Montana this summer. That was one of our big trips we wanted to do and check out the Locksaw, and prettiest country I've seen, man.
Yeah, it's amazing. I feel like this, the little town Orofino, it's kind of like a gateway to the just everything. I mean, there's a lot of history from Lewis and Clark passing through these mountains back in the day, and then just all the beautiful backcountry here. It's amazing. There's not much to do here besides outdoorsy stuff, so that's why I love it so much.
Cool. Well, let's go through your elk hunting learning curve. I do think we should mention you're pretty much blue collar guy. You work full time. You hunt when you can. You know, you got to save up vacation. You're like the rest of us.
Absolutely.
You got a daughter in college. You got bills to pay, all that kind of stuff. So are you married?
Yep.
And want to hear about that too, how Mama Bear puts up, because you hunt a lot. I want to hear about that. Some of the like least sexy topics, but I mean, the stuff I can relate to.
Yeah.
And probably the listeners as well. But let's get into your elk hunting learning curve, the early days, what you were doing, and looking obviously retrospectively, what you could have done better.
Yeah. So I started out deer hunting. That was my thing. And my dad, he was pretty old. He was 50 years old when I was born. So he was pretty old. He kind of been there, done that in the hunting, for rifle and such when he was a young man. And by the time I got to be hunting age, he was just kind of over it. Right. You know, it wasn't the same kind of hunting. You know, they had awesome hunting in Idaho back when he first moved here, and things had kind of gone downhill, and he didn't really want to get after it. But me listening to all of his old stories, and him and my uncle would tell stories about all the adventures they had. And I was all about it. I just devoured hunting magazines back then. Just went through page by page and looking at the pictures and reading the stories and lived vicariously through that. And then, so I started deer hunting, you know, and a lot of times, you know, it's kind of crazy, but 12, 13 years old, my mom would, after school or before school, she would go drop me off in the woods, and I'd go hunting, till like after school till dark. I'd be waiting where she dropped me off at dark. That's kind of crazy these days. Not a lot of 13 year olds you would feel okay with dropping them off and coming back at dark for, but that's the way things were back then. And man, I loved it. And one year I thought I was going to do a bear bait and bait in a bear, because I'd been seeing bear tracks along this old pond. And so we took some some stinky stuff out there and put it along the pond bank in a little spot where he'd have to come out where I could see this bear. And I thought, man, I'm for sure going to get a bear. Had my dad drop me off a couple miles down the road so I could walk in the dark and be, and I sat there in the dark for probably an hour, maybe 30 minutes before first light. And this was opening day of bear season. And coincidentally, opening day archery season too, for deer and elk. I'm sitting there with my rifle waiting for this bear to come in. And the sun comes up and I hear a bunch of crunching around in the brush. And I'm like, oh man, here comes that bear. I'm going to get him. And it wasn't a bear at all. It was some elk. It was a couple, three cows and a raghorn bull. And they walked out and they walked over and got in the pond and drank water and splashed around a little bit. And I was just like, right there. They were right there, 15 yards. And all I could think was, dang, if I had a bow, I could totally kill this bull. And I was just, I didn't know what to do. You know, I wanted to shoot this elk. So I just sat there and enjoyed it, soaked it all in, and they left. And I couldn't wait till my dad come back to pick me up. And he came by a few hours later and picked me up. And first thing I said, I'm like, we have to go to town and we have to buy some arrows with broadheads on them, because I had a recurve bow, like a 50-pound bow, but I'd never shot any broadheads through it or nothing. I'm like, we got to go to town. We got to get these arrows because I'll be right back there in the morning. I'm going to kill that bull. And he's like, no, you're not going to do that. You can't kill an elk with a bow. I'm like, no, you can. I'm going to do it. And he's like, nope, nope, nope. So I started saving my money. I was 14 at the time. So okay. I started saving my money. And the next summer, I worked all summer in the hay fields, bucking bales and putting up hay for local farmers. And I saved all of my money so I could buy my first bow rig. I got a compound bow, a high country trophy hunter bow with a dozen arrows. And I got all the gear. I bought some polar fleece camouflage and everything. And I was all in. I went all in. And I had a video a teacher gave me that had hunts on it. It was a tape, a VHS tape with Larry D. Jones and Dwight Shue and all those old guys. And Elk Fever, you know, all that those era videos. There's like 7 hours of videos on this one tape. And I just watched it. And my dad could see I was kind of going all in on this. And he's like, well, tell you what, if you get a bull, then I'll pay you back for all the money you spent on your gear. I'm like, deal.
Good deal.
Yeah. He knew he was safe. There was no way I was going to get a bull, right? I mean, this dumb 15-year-old kid, I don't even have a driver's license. So I practiced with my bow and I did all my scouting, and I knew all the farmers from working in the fields and stuff. And this, a couple of them let me hunt. So opening day, my best friend and I, we're right there watching these elk, and I forgot my bugle tube. Or wait, no. I forgot my bugle tube, and my brother-in-law, he's my brother-in-law now, but he's my best friend back there. He had a bugle tube, but he forgot his diaphragm reeds. I said, here, give me that tube, and I'll bugle for you. And he's like, no, you'll call it to you, and you'll shoot it. We hadn't got the teamwork thing figured out yet. So he had this weird bite and blow elk call. It was made by Elk Inc. Eastman's used to sell these things, the little elk talk call. It looked like two plastic credit cards stuck together with a rubber band. Anyway, he jabbed that thing in the end of that tube and blew on it and went bouncing across through this wheat field that hadn't been cut yet. And this bull, and he put his bow above his head, and this bull seen him and went over there. And, I thought the elk was going to kill him. It came in a dead run. Well, it ran right up there and he missed the thing. So, So that was our first day of elk hunting with a bow.
Pretty good.
Fast forward, 3 days, my buddy got in trouble, lipped off to his old man or something. So he was grounded. He couldn't go. So I had my mom take me out, and we were out on the state ground, and I got this bull bugle in, and We exchanged bugles for a while. Anyway, I called him right into 15 yards and I shot that sucker. It was the third day of season, third day of elk hunting I'd ever had. And she went back home and told my dad to get the come along because he was going to be able to load it whole, right? It's flat ground and logging road. Said, bring your come along and your checkbook. Your boy got an elk. So after that, it was history. But I'd kind of reached out to a couple old timers there that had bow hunted elk before and try to get a little mentoring from them, you know, try to get picked up on some ideas. And they told me a few things, but nothing that really seemed real valuable. And I kind of seen these elk videos and I could see what kind of expect, how the elk would come in and how to prepare for the shot and such. But in my mind, I kind of thought, well, what are elk doing when they're bugling back and forth to each other? Well, they're getting pissed off and they're wanting to fight. Well, how would I, if I were an elk and I wanted to fight that elk over there, how would I do that? Well, I would, you know, talk smack back and forth, you know, work my way over there, beat the crap out of a tree or whatever, and, you know, get up in there, you know, get close as I can and make them think I'm an elk coming to fight them. And well, I got lucky. I mean, that actually worked. And to this day, that's still the same kind of premise, you know, I operate on. When I get a bull to bugle, I just want him to think I'm not a hunter anymore. I'm another elk and I'm trying to fight that guy. I'm picking a fight with him. I want to go fight that other bull or make him think I'm going to try to fight him and then get him mad enough to where he comes in.
Yes.
And it seems to work. It seems to work.
Yeah, I think that Idaho bulls in particular are definitely more of that. You got to be aggressive. You hunted Wyoming? What other states have you hunted elk and kind of got a feel for the different styles that are necessary?
I've hunted Wyoming quite a bit. Hunted Montana 1 year. Hunted Oregon 1 year. That's it.
Yeah. So do you still employ your pretty aggressive tactics? Like I'm going to threaten you until you do something about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I do. I think if you have to act like an elk, you can't analyze it like I'm a hunter. I'm going to try to sneak over there and kill him. No, I'm an elk. I want to get you pissed off and I want you to fight me. And that's kind of what I go with. So I could use a pretty aggressive approach. But a lot of times it all kind of depends on the temperature or the attitude of the elk. You know, if he's not super worked up, then you can't go for the throat right away. You know, it's like prom night, you know, you might want to put your arm around her before you try to French kiss her. Right.
Yeah.
You got to kind of work your way into it. Some bulls they're fired up. I mean, you can go whole hog right off the bat with them and get aggressive. It just kind of depends. It's so situational, very, very different every time. But
so have you hunted with a lot of newbie hunters?
My kids mostly, they're newbies. And I've taken a couple guys out that hadn't hunted much. And my brother-in-law, which we grew up best friends, we've hunted a lot together, but it's almost hunting with him. I'd hate for him to hear this, but it's almost like I'm hunting with a newbie hunter with him. Cause he's got a different thought process. He's more of a rifle hunter mentality, more of a kind of be quiet, sneak up, you know, very methodical, which was not wrong. It's just different than the way I do it. So sometimes it's difficult, but with the kids, like my son, you know, it took him bow hunting since he was 12. And so there was a lot of newbie type hunting stuff there.
I wanted to get into, like, obviously a lot of the mistakes guys are making and see if we can kind of clean that up now. But I got to set the framework for my next question, which was the Maverick. You teamed up with Phelps and made a call. Tell me about that. Is it a single? Is it a double? I feel like I might have used it this year. I think I did, but I'm not sure. That sounds terrible. But, you know, Phelps sent me a gaggle of calls, and I'm just like, you know, in the dark grabbing whatever. And, you know,
yeah,
I prefer a single until I know it's like go time. Then I probably switch to a double, but I always have everything on me. What, tell me about the Maverick and kind of what you guys collaborated on and the background on that.
So the Maverick is a single latex reed.
Okay.
It usually takes a heck of a guy with a heck of a big bunch of lungs to blow a double. So, and I've always liked a single reed. when Phelps and I worked on this, he sent me, I don't know how many, 15 or 20 different reeds with different latexes, different thicknesses of latexes, different stretches of latexes. So we kind of had an idea what I liked, but we wanted to kind of, you know, not leave anything on the table. We want to make sure, you don't want to assume. So I went through all those and just one after another, blew this one, blew that one, blew this one, blew that one. And then within the first go around through all of those, I'd picked out about five or six that I liked. Mm-hmm. And then I narrowed it down from there. But I wanted something that I blow pretty hard. So I wanted something that's going to be durable and that would take that extra air pressure. So I wouldn't overblow it, you know, cause when I get excited calling in elk, I tend to blow really hard. Cause I'm like, I'm mad. I want to show you I'm mad with a big mean challenge bugle or whatever. And I wanted that to be able to take it and sound good, not distort. Cause some calls the latex is a little too thin and they'll kind of cut out on you. So, kind of narrowed it down to that. And then I wanted, there was some that are all about the same thickness of the green latex that we selected for this one, but the different colored latexes or whatever, they didn't have the same rich tone as the green one for me. So, you know, I tried all these different bugles, these different tones, these different grunts, different screams, and it had the best rich tone, and it would just stand up to whatever I threw at it. So then we kind of narrowed it down with the different stretches. We stretched it super tight. We stretched it not quite so tight till we found like a really good stretch. But then we dialed it in even further because, of course, the public, Joe Public, is not me. They're gonna have to take this thing out, call out of a package and blow it and have it work reasonably well for them. So with that in mind, we kind of tweaked a little bit on the stretch a little bit more to where I wanted something that when you took it out of the package, it would bugle lights out. The cow calls are a little bit chirpy right out of the package, but that's part of the design because a lot of calls, if it comes out of the package perfect on cow calls and bugles, after some hard calling, it'll stretch out pretty quickly. And then you kind of lose that sweet spot. I wanted this thing to settle into a sweet spot after 30 bugles or so, and then stay there for quite a while.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what we found, with the stretch on there now. So, it's got a good break-in period and then it kind of just settles in and stays there for quite a while.
So I talked to a couple guys and they were like, man, I blew out a reed. And I didn't blow out a single reed this year. Is that common for you? Are you blowing out reeds?
In the past, I've blown out some, seriously blew out some reeds, you know. You might go through 10 a year, you know.
Okay.
So in some of them, you take them right out of the package and you blow on it. It's like, dud, throw it away. Immediately throw it away. You can't even bugle with it. It doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
So, but that was one of the things that, you know, when Jason, I've known Jason for a long time. We've been friends for a long time. And he kept pounding me. Let's collaborate. Let's do a call. So I finally said, you know, I want to get a call. I want to be able to use calls and I want people that trust my opinion to use calls that every time they pull it out of a package that they have confidence it's going to be good and reliable. And man, I found that, you know, for a couple of years leading up to collaborating, he'd sent me several calls and every single one of them was just good. It was dynamite, spot on. So that kind of led me down the road to working with him on the call. And, you know, he put a lot of faith in me and he put a lot of trust in me. And I felt that was pretty cool. So we did this thing and it's kind of taken off from there.
Yeah. That makes sense, man. You mentioned elk fever and that got me so pumped because,
oh yeah.
Last week I left voicemails on Larry D. Jones and Dwight Shoe's cell phones to get them on this podcast.
Oh, wow.
I usually get my super blue collar you haven't heard of. Those are the ones I kind of key on. But I've gotten a few industry people, right. and I was like, well, I'm great. I'm bringing Dirk on. You're pretty well known, dude, I think people know who you are and that you're really successful and you're hanging out with the Elk 101 crew and the Phelps crew. And but Larry and I actually hunted together a couple years, over 10 years ago, actually. But so I'm like, man, I got to get him on here before he kicks the bucket. And I actually said that on my voicemail, because that's how Larry is. Yeah. He's a pretty cool guy. You can make fun of how old he is. And then Dwight is super serious, but pretty dry, sarcastic. But we'll see if those old timers, like, you can't send 70-year-olds text. I don't think you can, at least. So I had to actually leave a voicemail. So we'll see if I can get them on. But that made me think of that. But what I want to ask you is, like, so growing up, Idaho, the heyday, what, just for my own personal, like, I just started hunting elk until the early 2000s in Idaho, and it was pretty amazing. What have you seen since you started up until 2018? What have you seen happen in Idaho with the elk, and kind of like take us through your own personal anecdotal observations, if you will?
Man, everything has changed. Completely changed for me and my elk hunting. Growing up, I lived where I could be elk hunting 10 minutes from my house. I was so, so blessed by having elk right 10 minutes from my house. And so I hunted before school and after school, which, you know, gave me so much time to screw it up or to do it right.
Yeah.
So that was awesome. And back then, everybody went to the backcountry. These were low country elk, you know, not too far out of town. And everybody went to the back country to hunt elk. So we had these elk to ourselves. Nobody bow hunted these things. So that was a real help, you know, for a newbie or a novice elk hunter, because, you know, of course we didn't know what the heck we were doing. But the elk would bugle. Awesome. We would bugle. My best friend, he lost every single arrow out of his quiver one morning. He missed like six bulls in one morning.
Good God.
If you can even imagine that.
Yes.
And it's flat ground. What, you could have loaded any of them whole, right? It's just, we'd get back to the truck and be like, we can never tell anybody about this because it's so good. Everybody goes to the mountains and here we are hunting easy elk and they're screaming everywhere. And so it was awesome. But as time went by, more and more people started figuring it out. You start seeing a more pick up here, a pick up there. You'd hear a guy bugling over there. And finally it got so bad that there was enough people, enough pressure, then the elk started reacting. And that made calling them a lot tougher. So, you know, we had to change our tactics up a lot. We had to become more aggressive. We had to push them harder. You know, before you could be semi-aggressive and they would come in, but now they would bugle and run. Well, on that flat ground, they can bugle and run all they want, but you'll be able to hem them up eventually, and they're going to get pissed off and turn around and come and fight. So that was still pretty good, but then it got to be where there was even more people, and I was kind of wanting more adventure too. I was starting to get a little older. Had a little more freedom, ability to drive myself somewhere, and I kind of wanted to go to the backcountry. So, had no clue, you know, I'd go hunting up there. I had a Mountain Dew and a pocket knife, you know, and no, not even have any game bags. I mean, didn't have a good pack frame, had no clue, but would go up there and didn't have much luck. Didn't know where we were going, didn't know what we were doing. So thank God. I don't know, you know, we probably would have had meat go bad if we had shot something. I mean, so, and my dad was no help. He was just like, nope, you'll figure it out yourself. Don't be shooting no elk down there. That meat won't help you pack. That meat won't help you pack it out at all. It'll just lay there. And well, he's right. It just lays there. It helps you not at all. It's terrible. It's difficult. It's the hardest thing you'll ever do.
So,
you know,
these herd bulls, like, how many satellites did they have compared to now? Is it the same deal, or is it like nothing close to what it was?
Well, back then in the heyday, so there would be this big herd bull. There'd be 30, 40 cows, and there'd be five or six satellite bulls. Seriously? Running around. Yeah. And this was, you know, flat ground. I can't speak to what the backcountry had, but you would talk to people and you would hear them tell stories. And they told the same kind of stuff. You know, there'd be 30 cows in a herd. There would be just chaos, you know, big bulls shoot, guys would shoot big bulls every year. So then finally, by the time I started figuring out kind of how to, you know, mid 90s, starting to figure it out a little bit, how to hunt the backcountry, start getting geared up a little better, starting to hear more bugles, starting to call a couple bulls in the backcountry. A lot of the biggest learning curve of the backcountry for me was just navigating the nasty country. I can hear a bull bugle, but how am I going to get there and get set up and call him in and then get him out? So that was kind of the biggest challenges. So, because, you know, it's North Idaho, it's brush like you never seen in most places. So it's pretty difficult. You know, a mile, 2 miles in North Idaho is like 6 miles in Wyoming.
It's the truth.
It's very difficult. It's true. So finally started figuring out how to navigate the nasty country, the back of Idaho, and fine-tuned my gear and started, you know, taking meat bags and started taking food and water and everything I needed to get one. And then I started killing them. But by then, there was still a few big bulls left. There was still some big ones, and there wasn't a lot of people hunting. But about the time I kind of figured that out, started calling in some monster bulls in the backcountry. Then we had our fuzzy friends, the wolves, be reintroduced. Mm-hmm. And now that you got you figured out the game and you've learned the rules of the game, everything's changed. The rules of the game have completely changed. And then, so that's kind of scrambling to try to figure out how to do it again. So,
well, how have your tactics changed with wolves increasing their population? They're not going anywhere. Yeah. And like, how have they affected your elk hunting? Like, what have you had to do, you know, evolving wise?
Well, pre-wolves, you could go set up your camp and be like, all right, I'm camping right here. I'm going to hunt these two drainages all season. And I can screw up the elk, but I can go back. I'll go to the other side of the canyon tomorrow and chase other elk. And then a day later, I'll come back to where I screwed them up and it'll be good again. You could do that. And just, you didn't have to travel too far from your camp. You could just kind of go back up to Old Reliable, and there would be elk there every year, and they wouldn't move too far if you busted them or whatever. Give them a couple days of rest and it'd be good to go. But now, since the wolves have come along, the elk seem to have, they've moved and to harder to hunt places. So back before, it was a little more gentle country. You can hunt a little less steep. Maybe you could find some pockets where it wasn't so brushy. Now that I find that it seems like they go to the nastiest, steepest, brushiest places, to live. So they're more difficult to get to. You can't bank on it. You can't say, well, I found these elk last week here, I'm going to go back next week and be in them. That sometimes changes day to day. You maybe have elk going great one day in a drainage, and the next day wolves will be howling, and it's like a spaceship beamed them out of there. They'll clamp down. The elk will quiet down. A lot of times they don't move too much. They just kind of hunker down. And so now what do you do? You know, I think a big mistake a lot of folks do is they don't switch out of that same mode. They're like, well, I know the elk are here and I'll get a chance. I'll get an opportunity at some point, and they'll just keep hunting there. But a lot of times those wolves have fouled it up for, you know, several days. So those elk go quiet, and then you kind of lose your opportunity to make something happen. So
yeah, I need elk to talk if I'm going to kill one.
Me too. If I couldn't call elk, I probably couldn't kill elk in Idaho, at least.
It's at least where we're at. I mean,
right,
that where we're at, that is a rule. Like, there's no spot in stock, and I don't even pack binos where I hunt. But, all right, well, let's help out-of-staters, even though I'm an out-of-stater, but let's help people about Idaho a little bit. The tag have sold out 2 years in a row. Thanks, Land of the Free, and whatever else is going on with, you know, it's a good thing. I like it.
Yep.
I just hope Idaho doesn't get greedy and increase the amount of tags. Yeah. But they probably will. Anyways, the guys coming to Idaho, it's a big state. It's so different depending on where you go. We are literally, all we've talked about so far is North Idaho. And I consider North Idaho from about where you're at to the Canadian border. And then it gets different. And then you have the Waihees, which is like more of like the Southwest desert country. And then you got some pretty big mountain ranges. You got the biggest wilderness and the lower 48, Frank Church. You got the Selway, which used to be the Mecca. You got the Lolos. And then you even have some really good country in the southwest, the southeast. People ask me all the time, where should I go in Idaho? So I feel like we should talk about it. Let's discuss it. Like, what's your thoughts on, you know, your typical guy or gal lives a long ways away from out west. They dream of elk hunting. They get inspired by these podcasts and videos, and they're like, I'm doing it. I'm gonna do this finally. I'm going to buy myself an OTC tag. They're in for a learning curve. But we're going to try to help them a little bit, not a lot, but a little. What do you have to say for someone coming to Idaho? Where would you point them?
I would first ask them, have you hunted where there's brush or heavy forests before? Because North Idaho is pretty alluring to a lot of people. And I kind of ask that question because a lot of people aren't used to this kind of brush. And it's almost a deal killer for them. So, you know, I try to find out, what are they used to? You know, let's make this as easy as possible for yourself, right? I mean, unless you're a veteran elk hunter and elk hunting's become too easy and you want to do something super hard, let's stack the odds in your favor. I would say look for the areas that aren't so brushy, and especially if you're a new hunter, maybe you don't need to go to the wilderness. I mean, some people want to go deep, you know, because that's what they want to do. And that's great. That's very commendable. But sometimes, let's say if you're new to elk hunting, that you might be setting yourself up to failure, because not only do you have all the struggles of the deep backcountry, then you also have to deal with elk. And you know how elk are. It's like they read the script and they change it on you all the time. So I would probably steer people toward areas that are a little easier to navigate. Maybe not go to the full on back country. Maybe hit some of the front country. You know, that's not nearly as sexy, but it's a little more easy to navigate if you're new. And some of the front country have more elk. You know, in North Idaho, it sure does. You know, the back country, it seems like the wolves kind of got them pushed out or eaten. So some of the front country closer to town holds a little more elk, but there's more hunting pressure too. So, but if you look at southern Idaho, I always tell people, if you take Idaho and cut the skinny part off, which is just south of McCall, basically anything south of McCall and kind of over, east of there, you kind of have kind of a rectangular, shape of Idaho left. And I know they have wolves in southern Idaho, but I still don't think they have them like we have up here. They thrive up here, and I don't think they do as much thriving down there as they do up here. And I think there's better elk densities in that part of Idaho. There's a lot more controlled rifle hunting in southern Idaho. So that's something to take in consideration too. So there's some units that have a controlled rifle hunt and have a non-controlled, you know, over-the-counter bow tag. So that means a lot, because, you know, your age class of elk, you're not killing as many elk every year. Your bulls are living longer, so you might have the opportunity to shoot a bigger bull or have more opportunity to see elk. So
I definitely agree with what you said. I was going to bring up McCall. It's a beautiful area. Anything south of there is good. Less wolf densities. Still not like you're still going to probably run into them. You got to use what you said and be mobile. But the biggest thing you've said there is, if you're looking into Idaho, you should do your research and figure out those areas that have a limited rifle but have an OTC elk. I can't even tell you some of the – it's shocking, some of the opportunity down south there. And if I lived closer, honestly, I would probably – that's probably where I'd go, get into some of that more – I mean, it's big country. It's steep, but, man, there's some sage – and then there's opportunity to glass. And there's a couple parts of Idaho that a little clue for those is, you can get yourself a Montana tag. You got to put in nowadays, because their general tag sells out. But you get yourself a General Montana, you get yourself an over-the-counter Idaho, you buy it before they sell out. You can hunt that fringe country, that border country. Just make sure you got tags in both states and you got your archery stamps or whatever, and read the regs and know where you're at, know where you stand, use your ONX, and there's some really good opportunity down there. Now, in Wyoming, you've been over there. Are you hunting, yeah. Have you hunted just general tags?
General, yeah. Yeah, they're the easiest to draw. You know, they're not super easy to draw, but I don't want to have to wait 8 years to draw a tag. I want to draw one as just as quick as I can. So we just put in for the general hunt.
100%. Now, when you hunted Montana, did you hunt Idaho Montana is what I call it, where it's just an extension of that brush country, or did you get away from that crap?
We got away from that crap. Yeah, we got to hunt lodge poles and stuff like that.
Oh, and the best.
And I always said, you know, man, if I could just call a bull into these lodge poles, man, we'd have it made. But those things are pretty tight sometimes, and 40 yards or 30 yards in lodge poles, that's not a gimme shot.
No, you're dead right. But the North Idaho thing is like, you need to be prepared. Yeah. If you come up here, you're going to call a bull in. Maybe. And when you do, there's a high percentage that bull is at 20 yards and you don't have a shot.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest.
Might not even see him.
You might not see him and he's right there, or you might see parts of his body and try to sneak one because you haven't done it yet. And you're in for some hurting when you see that arrow deflect or you hit him not where you wanted to. And especially if you're new to elk, if you haven't had that many elk in front of you in bow range, no matter what practice you've done or whatever, you need reps in that situation for where to set up, when to draw, when to stop them, all that kind of stuff, what they're going to do. And usually you're rushing. Almost all the new hunters I've worked with, they just rush and they have way more time than they think. So all that comes with experience. So get yourself some good experience and maybe a little more friendlier country. You know, I've hunted New Mexico pretty early on when I could draw tags. I haven't drawn New Mexico since 2007. But wow. I've only had two New Mexico tags. And looking back, I wasn't that good of a hunter. I was just pretty determined. And I got bulls killed both times. New Mexico is a dream of a place. So for new hunters, try to get yourself a New Mexico tag. But make sure that, you know, anywhere in that state is good. You know, a lot of people zone in on that, those, you know, the Gilas, the 16s and all that. But man, that's compared to where I hunt, that is like a vacation hunt. That is fun hunting. You're seeing elk, you're glassing, and you can learn a lot more, I think, when you can see elk and watch them do their vocalizations and their behaviors. And you really start to learn more about elk. Where you're hunting where we are, you're kind of blind and you're really just cueing off sound and sign. And that's about really all you can work with in Idaho, North Idaho, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is the North Idaho episode. This is fun. Well, that's what we know. I mean, it's our backyard. It's really fun. It's good country. I would say, have you hunted Roosevelt's?
No.
I feel like you and I could do pretty good on Roosevelt's, just given that we've been hunting this brush country. I feel like we wouldn't be like too freaked out about some swamp bulls. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, going into the forest, not seeing where you're heading and just going for it and figuring it out. Yeah.
Spending an hour to go a quarter mile. It's freaking awesome. Yeah. You know, it's one of those deals. So,
yeah.
Well, we're going to get into a little bit of tactics on these bulls and sounds and whatnot. So when do you usually head out for your first trip of the year? If you had to pick 1 week out of September, which one would you pick and why?
If I'm in Idaho, depend on where at I'm in Idaho. But if I'm in Idaho, it's going to be the second part of the month. Bulls just seem to bugle better late for me. And I think I've kind of heard you talk about having some decent luck calling early. But where I go, man, I don't have good luck early at all. And I like that last week, the very last week of September. Which some people are like, oh no, it's too late, or everything's over with, or whatever. But I really get better bugling during that last week of September.
Okay.
But if I'm going to out of state, you know, if I'm going to Wyoming, it's the first week of September, or maybe the second. there's better bull densities, I think, but more better elk densities. I think they rut different. Maybe because their climate and where they're at, I don't know, but, I like that early. You talk to Corey, you know, he likes Idaho the first 2 weeks too, because, you know, the big bulls aren't cowed up yet, yada, yada, yada. But for where I go in North Idaho, I like the last week.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say I haven't been to Wyoming since 2000 something, six or seven. I'm supposed to go this year. I think everyone knows what happened there. I'm going back. I got my points back. I got a refund. Thank you, Wyoming. I did a medical deal where.
Yes.
And God bless them. Got my really expensive special tag back. That was expensive. But
wow.
The points was really what I was worried about. But so I'm coming back, Wyoming. Look out. But I would say, like, so check this out. Like, I would say New Mexico, Nevada. I'm just going off where I've hunted for elk. Get me there early, please. Nevada was amazing early season this year. I mean, it was just mind-blowing. I'm talking September 1, just like my best days in Idaho. If you looked at, like, all the elk I've killed throughout the years, I bet you could put majority of them between the 18th and 22nd in Idaho. So that lines up with what you're saying. Like, yeah, I like hunting the bulls earlier because they're not cowed up yet. I feel like my chances are better. But when it comes down to I need to get a bull killed, put me there between the 18th and the 25th. And someone's going to die. Montana, conversely, if they wouldn't sell out their tags, my old program was to buy a Montana tag, depending on how the year went, around October 1st. And hunt Montana the last 10 days of their season archery, and you'd have the woods. You'd have the woods to yourself. The elk had been boogered, but they just there's like they got a little break, and the hunting was always really good, and the weather was always really nasty. So I felt like I was always hunting in the snow a little bit, but it worked out pretty good. I had some very good years, but I haven't been to Montana in quite a few years. But that program is still probably viable if you're willing to put in a little extra work. And maybe save some of your vacation for that first week, second week in October. Go to Montana, get yourself, and don't go to brushy Montana, Idaho, Montana. Stay far away from there. Get to that lodge bowl country.
Yeah.
I would say I haven't hunted Oregon yet, so I can't talk to it. But any time of the year is good if you can put together some dates. And that's one thing I preach on the learning curve, Dirk, is like, get yourself some time in the woods. Now, you had kind of a special deal. Like, you hunted before school. And you were telling me a story one time. Like, your shop teacher was, like, pretty cool. If you got into bulls, you could kind of be a little late because he wanted to hear what was going on in the woods. But, like, if you think about it, how many hours, days, weeks did you put together as a kid in high school hunting elk?
Oh, tons. So, you know, and if I was tagged out, I would still go, you know, for my buddy, you know?
Yeah.
So, or my brother. So I was out every day of season, you know, all through high school from 15 years old till I had to start working for a living when I was 18. So
yeah, definitely.
I didn't play sports. I did hunting. So
do you think these guys coming out hunting, trying to get to that learning curve? I mean, what do you think is a good number of days they should realistically plan on hunting? Is five enough? Seven? I mean, you got travel in there. Or do you think they should go 2 weeks? I mean, obviously the answer is as much as you can, but what do you think like a good formula would be?
Yeah. Yeah. 10 days at least, that 2 weekends and the weekend between those weekends is kind of good because everything can change within that time period and it can go from bad to good and then back to, or from good to bad, then back to good again in that amount of time. So I'd at least allow 10 days if you can swing it, but swing whatever you can. If you got a weekend warrior, you got to get out there. You just got to do it if you live close enough.
Yeah. And I liked what you've said when we were on the phone. I mean, we should have recorded our conversation last week. You had some good stuff.
Yeah.
You've been hunting a different style. Like you said, you've been hunting kind of out of your truck, setting up a camp in a central location, but driving 30, 40, 50 miles a day
yeah.
to check out different areas and stuff like that. I think you should talk about that a little bit. I think people should understand like the why behind what you're doing there, because it's pretty, I think it makes a lot of sense to where I'm coming from, but tell us about that.
Yes. So I don't think a lot of people understand maybe what it takes, because a lot of what you see is the big base camps, or, and you know, you go to your big base camp and you just hunt there, you know, kind of like we did 20, 30 years ago. Or you maybe backpack in, which is sexy as can be and fun, but a lot of this North Idaho stuff, you just can't do that. So what I do is I set up a base camp in a central location, and I have my plan A, B, C, all through Z. So I can go out in any direction from my central location. So one day I drive, let's talk about 2017 season. My first day, I drove over 50 miles from camp to hunt elk, right? To find elk, to hunt elk. I knew, you know, I kind of had an idea where some bulls would possibly be from hunting there before. Hunted over there, chased bulls all day long up until dark, and then drove all the way back. The next day, and I got into bulls, and I got almost killed a big one. The next day, I didn't go back because there was a lot of wolves, a lot of wolf pressure and a lot of people in that direction. The next day, I drove probably 25 miles in the opposite direction to try something different. And the reason I do this is because you gotta stay mobile. Just people get in a rut. I think they go back to the same spot. You know, the old adage, don't leave elk to find elk. That sometimes holds true, but there's some exceptions to that, I feel like. So if there's excessive hunting pressure, if there's excessive predators, wolves, you may have a bunch of elk here, but it's going to be very difficult to kill them in this one place. So don't get married to that place. Try something different. And I started doing this several years ago because you just keep beating your head against the wall and the days tick by and you run out of time and you didn't get anything. So I go a complete opposite direction that I'd done my research, I'd done my scouting, went somewhere else. And that morning called in, or actually it wasn't that morning, that midday, called in a big old bull and shot him and spent the next 3 days packing him. But I don't think a lot of people think about that. You know, you might want to change your spot, you know, maybe 5 miles this way or 5 miles that way, but sometimes it takes thinking out of the box and doing things the other people don't do or won't do to make you successful, to get it done.
That's awesome, man. I need to get outside my box. I hunt about 20 square miles, but I've thought about checking out some other areas, and fitness is my biggest ally, so I'm not afraid to cover country. Got a dirt bike, got a four-wheeler truck, whatever it takes, I'll get there, boots on the ground, but I think you're right. I think for guys coming to anywhere, any state, be ready to be mobile. Game plan is to be flexible and to not be afraid to cover new country and know when to pull the plug. I think that's going to help people in the long term. I want to finish with some Corey Jacobson stuff. Like, you guys have hunted together a lot. You grew up together. Do you guys hunt really well together? Do you feel like you guys are a really good team? Did it start that way? If that's true, how did that process evolve? Hunting partners, picking the right one, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So I think we've both have always kind of had that mindset, the same maybe process of how to call in bulls and be aggressive. In the beginning, in high school, we hunted a little bit together, and then he went off to college, and I went to work, and so we didn't hunt much together then, and several years passed, and then here, probably 2012, we started hunting a lot again together, and everything we both learned in that period of time, we kind of brought back and shared with each other, and he's a really good hunter. He's a killer. And I felt like we meshed really well. I didn't have to tell him, like a new hunter, you would have to say, okay, go set up by the tree. I mean, he knew where to go set up, and, or if he's calling for me, he knew where to go, back up and call, or he would know how to like try to work around to for the terrain to where the bull would come in where the wind was good, and vice versa. You know, we, it's like we didn't have to have that conversation. We just knew what to do. So in that respect, we hunt really well together.
You guys hit it off from the word go, or was there just like any process? Was there like a little feeling out stage? You do the call and no, I'll do the call and you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. I don't know. It's like, it's almost like, hey, why don't you be the shooter? No, why don't you be the shooter? We both kind of wanted the other person to shoot. So, it didn't seem to be like a too big of a deal. We just kind of worked it out. And before we kind of take turns through the day, you know, be a caller shooter, but that's kind of evolved into like, now if you're the shooter, you're shooter for the day.
Okay.
And a lot of times the caller don't even pack a bow. So that way you can focus strictly on the calling, rather than calling and then setting up for yourself as well. So that seems to work out pretty good. Other than, let's say, the only thing I don't like about that is, let's say you've had a bad day. Let's say you miss a bull and it hurts. It hurts, especially if it's big or whatever. Let's say you mess up on one. You kind of still have to dust yourself off, get back on the saddle and ride again. And sometimes that's kind of difficult to do. So you don't have that opportunity to let it simmer for a day or whatever, and then like get good with yourself again. So that is one, one tough part with being the shooter all day. So you try not to make a mistake, but it happens.
I have been accused by my dad a couple of times of being the caller and really just all of a sudden setting it up for myself. And so my dad and I, we've had our arguments on the mountain, but we've evolved to where when I do hunt with him, I am the caller and I leave my bow at home, and we don't hunt together very many days. But when we do, we try to put those days close to those dates I was talking about in Idaho, kind of that third week time. If I don't have a bull down already, I'll usually just stop what I'm doing and hunt with him. And his birthday is the 22nd, so I've always kind of, his birthday present is, hey, I'm calling for you today. And it's helped a lot just leaving the bow at home. And even this year, I posted the video day by day of my hunts in Idaho, and he's the star of the show for a couple days because he's just my shooter. And you know, one of those things happened where he totally screwed up on a bull twice that he should have killed, both times at 5 yards.
Dang.
Yeah. And I think had I had my bow, we could have been like, all right, dude, why don't you chill out for the rest of the day and just call? Because his head was not in it, man. Like, he just kept, you know, I think you're absolutely right. So there's something to be said about that. But, well, Dirk, yeah, where do people follow you? Like, obviously Instagram, but you're doing some YouTube stuff now too. Are you on the Land of the Free this year? Like, tell us what you got cooking.
Yeah. So, Land of the Free 2.0, I went hunting with Born and Raised Outdoors, Jason Phelps and Nick Schmidt down in Colorado this last September, first week of Colorado. We hunted down there and that was pretty fun. Did a backpack bivy hunt for my first full on bivy hunt ever.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was tough. It's kind of like bivy hunt in North Idaho, but maybe worse because it was at 10,000 feet.
Oh gosh.
It was tough country, very tough country, but we had a good time. The company made up for it. But that just kicked off last night. Land of the Free 2.0 did. So that'll probably in a week or two, you'll be able to see that hunt that I was involved with. And then Corey Jacobson, Donnie Drake, and I hunted in Wyoming again this year. And we filmed that for the video series Destination Elk for YouTube. And that's gonna kick off, I believe it is the 7th. So on Monday, November 7th, that kicks off on YouTube. So that'll be a cool series to watch. And I have a YouTube channel of my own. I haven't put much on there except a couple of goofy videos that I did, and one for boiling a skull out. But little by little, I'll get some content on there. But Social media wise, you can find me on Instagram. I'm the Bugler. That's one word. And then on Facebook, it's just Dirk Durham.
That's the man. So we're doing Elk Shape Camp 2019. Every waking second, I'm trying to scramble and put together the content for that, like actual the fitness side of stuff, like nutrition manual,
yeah,
the training manual, all that stuff that I feel like people need tangibly. Like they've got to have it in their hands before they leave. And I'm going to make them fly to Spokane. I'm going to make them regret every second that they came. Not really, but we're going to, I do want it to be formidable. I want it to be something that could potentially be life changing. I feel like I have, like, my whole life's work is helping people in their fitness, and my passion is elk hunting. So when I get a chance to do both, I'm really happy guy. And so I'm going to bring him in, and I talked to Phelps, and he sounded like he wanted to come down for that, but I know how busy he is. So I went ahead and called the Maverick, the Bugler, and tried to get you to pencil in the first weekend of March. But there's a good chance you're going to be the guy coming up doing the elk calling part, because I feel like you can't have an elk-shaped camp without elk calling. And it can't be something that you just – it's got to be hands-on in person, get reeds in people's mouths, and get them learning right then and there. So hopefully it works out to where you're the guy.
Yeah, I'll definitely be there. I've already written that down.
That's pretty cool, man. I'm
pretty excited for it.
Yeah, me too. And you know, I'm going to cap it at 20 guys, but I just want quality over quantity. And I feel like – I'm in a really special situation where my gym is big enough. We can handle that. We can get everybody's biometrics, get them the nutrition information and the training information. That stuff's easy. But the part that I feel super fortunate is having one of my really good friends owns one of the best archery shops around, Spokane Valley Archery. And he's been awesome. He's like, yeah, man, you guys can totally come here on Sunday. We'll close it. We'll keep it just for you guys. I'll be available. And I was like, well, can we do some video analysis? Just, you know, everyone's got a phone these days. Throw a little slow-mo on and watch their shooting form. Because this guy, man, he busts my balls on my technique every time I'm in there. Like, he gives me just that one. He's like a good coach. Like, anyone in, like, where I'm at when I train athletes is it's just that one magic slogan or cue, whether it be, you know, a good cue is different for everybody, but just that one cue to really fix or tighten up your groups. And he's got a 3D course. It's like 16 targets with some topography in there that we can get guys shooting with backpacks on and shooting under duress and work on some angles. And I'm excited. I feel like we can kind of cover it all in one weekend and hopefully elevate some people's game when it comes to elk hunting. So that's my vision, and I'm super stoked to have you. So I wanted to tease people about that. We haven't done registration yet. I'm still working on making sure everything's dialed, and then open that up probably in December. So,
oh, that's awesome. That sounds really fun. Yeah. Maybe you can help me quit being a fat kid too.
Well, how much weight did you lose in Colorado, fat kid?
Let's see. I think I lost about 20 pounds.
Are you kidding me?
Overall, during hunting season. So from September 1 till I got done. So I lost about 20 pounds.
More importantly, what was the first thing you ate when you got out of that Colorado backcountry?
Everything. That's what I love about September. I can eat.
Yeah. I love that juicy burger and ice cold beer when you come out of the backcountry. It's the best.
Yeah, it is.
That's cool. Well, Dirk, I can't wait to watch you on TV. My TV upstairs is big, and I just connected to YouTube. So I'm going to totally dial in and wish my off-season blues away by living through you. So thanks for doing all that. It's not easy to be filmed. It's not easy to film and to do that. So, I mean, it sounds easy on paper, but what you guys are doing is really awesome, and I know it's just hard. So thank you for putting the effort in.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm glad to have you on finally.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
All right, man. We'll talk soon.
Okay, sounds good.
Take care.